it's no stretch to say that we are living right now in 2017 through a particularly turbulent time in our world, in our culture. You know, we've experienced an unusual string of natural disasters and all of the struggles and strains that come with that. We are in an era of acute political and social division, a time of just angry words and people not really listening to each other or seeking to understand. It's a season of racial tensions rising up in a new and surprising way, even within the church. The church is having new conversations about race, and there's been some aspects of healing, but some aspects of new division opening up. Politically speaking, it's a time of international uncertainty. North Korea pursuing nuclear weapons and all of that. You have the rise of nationalism in different countries and separatism and those sorts of things, refugee crises, and then, you know, the longer-term challenges of poverty and political corruption. And then on a social side, we're still coming to grips, I think, with our interconnectedness and the cultural and personal and social toll of social media and what that means for us. And this, none of this is speaking at all about the personal struggles that we might be going through in our own lives and our family lives. And so what are we to do in a season of turbulence like this? You know, how does God want us to meet a moment like this? What might God want to do in us and through us in a time of upheaval like we're living through? I really do believe that historians are going to look back on this time as a time of unusual cultural and social turbulence, certainly in our country, but around the world. And so what does God want to do in us and through us in a time like this? I think one of the problems we face when we're going through a time like this is that our view of ourselves and our view of God gets easily warped by the cultural narrative. And then this is kind of how it looks. When we're experiencing challenges and social strains, we kind of fall into this thinking that, you know, if God is in control, then we should see an absence of personal struggles or cultural commotion. If he's really in control, we shouldn't see these things. If he's really in control, shouldn't we see, you know, Christians in the top levels of leadership in our country and around the world? If God's really in control, shouldn't more people be living out a biblical worldview and following Christ? Shouldn't we see more peace within our churches? Shouldn't we see more people making church, being a part of a church body, a priority in their life? Shouldn't we see more people revolving their worlds around Christ? We don't see those things in a lot of cases, and so we come to this conclusion that God is not present, he's not in control, and he's not trustworthy. Have you ever thought anything along those lines? I have found myself thinking those. Sometimes I don't realize I'm thinking that way until something kind of snaps me out of it. But those assumptions about God are not true, and they're not biblical. Because the Bible is actually full of examples of God being firmly in control when everything from our vantage point seems like it's going off the rails. It certainly did not seem like God was in control when Christ was tried and crucified. And yet, God's grand plan for our redemption was underway. And so a biblical worldview is one that believes that God's sovereignty and his power and his love and trustworthiness, all those attributes, they are not established by nor undermined by the difficult circumstances that we're experiencing. Christ is the same yesterday, today, and forever. And that transcends whatever turbulence we're experiencing. And I think one of the most dramatic examples when we think about this is the life of Elijah. Some of you may be familiar with Elijah. He's one of the maybe better known figures from the Old Testament period. You may know the stories about his life. You may not know anything about Elijah other than it's one of the most popular baby names in our country right now. Number eight, I looked it up. Number eight, most popular boy name. There were 30,000 Elijahs born in America last year. But their namesake, the biblical Elijah, can really teach us a lot. He's worth our attention, not only because he's, you know, his story is in the Bible and he's part of the history of God's people, but I think he's worth our attention because of the moment that he lived in. You know, he lived in a time that was just as chaotic socially, politically, and spiritually as our world, if not more. And it was from multiple fronts. You know, Israel lived in a place that was surrounded by cultures that believed very different things from them. And so there was all this antagonism toward Israel all the time of these nations that had different worldviews. But not just that, Elijah's living during a time that the leaders of Israel, the kings of Israel, were also abandoning God. And so Elijah is trying to respond to both of those. You know, I'm living in a God's people, the nation of Israel, that's supposed to live differently than the rest of the world, but now the leaders of our nation are starting to accommodate and look like the surrounding nations. And so he had to figure out a way to rely on God and to stay faithful in that kind of environment. He had to live counterculturally. He had to live against the tide of culture. And we are called to do the same thing. We are called to live counterculturally. And I want to define what that means and what it does not mean, counterculturally. God calls us to live in a certain way. He wants us to honor him in the way that we live, to pursue Christ-likeness. And that path of following him is at odds in many ways with the surrounding culture, with secular values. For example, our understanding of our purpose in life is very different because of who Christ is. Where we gain our self-worth is a different place than the rest of the culture. Our view of relationships is different. The way we view our money and how we spend our time and serving others, all those things are very against the grain of a broader secular culture. But living counterculturally is not so simplistic and black and white that it's kind of like, well, we're Christians and we live this way and the rest of the world is just totally off the map and they're just evil and we're not. That is not the way that we're supposed to view it. And that's actually not reality, because there are actually multiple fronts of culture that we are meant to live counter to. And sadly, as it was in Elijah's time, there are elements of even Christian culture and church culture that we are meant to live counter to, because we are sinful people, and within the church, within Christian culture, there are aspects that begin to not resemble what God actually called us to do, what Christ actually calls us, how he calls us to live. And so there are streams within Christianity even that we are meant to live counter to. Streams, for example, that make Christianity all about our moralism and we just need to follow all the rules and earn God's favor. That's not the gospel. We have to live counter to that. A judgmental, condemning attitude toward the rest of the world. We are not meant to live that way, and yet it's so easy for us to fall into that, kind of just falling into a scornful culture war attitude toward people who are not Christians, even though these are the very people we are supposed to be reaching out to and loving. We can't do that if we also view them as being at war with us culturally. You know, there are also streams within the church of being too accommodating to the rest of the culture and not standing for the truth. And so there are all these fronts of culture within the church and outside of the church that we are meant to live counter to. And we've got to ask God's help to do that. There are multiple fronts of living counterculturally. And Elijah's story helps us to see how we can do that. And we'll talk a little bit more in a moment about what it looks like to live counterculturally. Another really interesting reason to look at Elijah is that his life and his ministry had a unique resonance with Christ and his ministry. It's been said that history doesn't repeat itself, but it rhymes. And I think that the ministry of Christ and what he did and what he was like, it rhymes a lot. There's some foreshadowing of Jesus's life in the life of Elijah, maybe more than any other Old Testament figure. And so we're going to jump in today into the very first time that we meet Elijah in the Old Testament. But before we do, I want to just spend a moment and kind of set the stage. So in the Old Testament period, God's people, the Israelites, lived in the Promised Land. This is a land that God set aside for them. This is where it was. I've got a map. I brought the maps today. It's an old favorite. So this is the ancient Near East. This area here, labeled as Canaan, became the Promised Land where Israel had their nation. God had promised it to them, and he led them into that land. And they were in a covenant relationship with God. God had made commitments to them and had certain responsibilities, and the people of Israel had made commitments back and had certain responsibilities. They were in this relationship with each other. God was going to be their God. They were going to enjoy him by living a certain way, and they were going to be a light to the nations around them. And when that relationship, that covenant between God and Israel was formalized, that was when the Ten Commandments came about. It was like, this is the first expression of how I would like you to live in this relationship with me. And I want to just read the first couple commandments, how this starts out, because it sets the stage for why Elijah is doing what he's doing. So Exodus 20, this is the Ten Commandments, it says this. This is God speaking. I am the Lord your God who, and here's what he's already done for Israel, who brought you out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery. And here come the commandments. You shall have no other gods before me. You shall not make for yourself an image in the form of anything in heaven, above, or on the earth, beneath, or in the waters below. You shall not bow down to them or worship them. It's the first thing God said. You worship me. Idols? No. That's not going to be who you are. And did you notice? You have to notice the first words of that. He doesn't just start dropping rules just because he wants to make rules. He says, I have already saved you out of my love for you. I rescued you. Therefore, live this way. So the relationship was based on love and rescue originally. But here are these rules. God saying, I'm real. I am God. All of these cultures around you are different. They worship all these gods and goddesses. They're polytheistic. They make little statues and they bow down and worship them. You're not going to do that. You are my people. You're going to be different. Those other gods, you're going to be enamored by them, but they're fake news, all right? These are not real things. These are little trinkets. And be aware that they're going to entice you. And so the terms of the covenant with Israel, it was very clear from the beginning. If you worship these other gods, these false deities, ultimately there's going to be consequences for that. And the consequence is expulsion from the promised land. And we see that at the end of the Old Testament. That happens. Sadly, the story of the Old Testament, it just goes more and more in that direction. And we see that we're incapable of keeping the rules. And eventually the people of Israel are exiled from the promised land as a punishment. And the story of Elijah comes right in the middle of that decline. That's what's happening. Elijah was a prophet. He lived about 850 years before Jesus. And God used Elijah to speak truth to power. Because the king of Israel at that time, so Elijah's a prophet, that's a religious role. The political power in Israel was a king, Ahab, who was an evil man. And the role of the ancient prophets was to speak on behalf of God to the people. So when God had a message, it came through the prophets. And at times, it meant that the prophets had to confront powerful political figures who had abandoned God and his commands. Because God was not just rubber stamping what the kings of Israel felt like doing. He was calling them out on their pride, on their idolatry, and he used the prophets to do it. So, for example, one of the more famous instances was when King David committed adultery with Bathsheba and had Bathsheba's husband killed, and that whole terrible story. The prophet Nathan walks right into the court, the throne room of David, and says, here's what God says about this, and called him out on it. And Elijah is going to do the same thing with King Ahab. That's the role he's going to play. And so let's get into the text. This is where we meet Elijah for the first time. It's in 1 Kings 17. On that note, just one kind of interesting thing about Elijah the prophet compared to some other prophets in the Old Testament. We don't have a book of Elijah. We don't have like a book of his writings. We read about him in third person in 1 Kings mainly. Whereas a lot of the other Old Testament prophets like Jeremiah, Isaiah, that we have some narrative about who they are, but mainly we know them through what they said, their writings. But Elijah, we read about him in 1 Kings especially. So let's get into it. 1 Kings 17, it says this. Now Elijah, the Tishbite from Tishba in Gilead, said to Ahab, as the Lord, the God of Israel lives, whom I serve, there will be neither dew nor rain in the next few years except at my word. So stop there for a second. There we meet the two figures, Elijah and Ahab, the prophet and the king. And Ahab is mentioned here as if you know who he is. You know, Elijah went to Ahab and said this. But if you back up a chapter in 1 Kings 16, you are introduced to Ahab. And it explains kind of what he's like. I'm not going to read it, but I'll give you the Cliff's Notes version. So when Ahab is introduced, it talks about all these kings of Israel had followed these idols, worshipped idols. Ahab was the worst. He was the worst of all of them. He married this woman named Jezebel, who was not an Israelite. She was from another culture, the Phoenicians up in the area of Sidon. They had a different culture. They had a different religious worldview. And Ahab married her and just fully embraced the worldview of her family and culture and the gods they worshipped. And so the most popular god of that part of the world, and it was embraced by the Sidonian culture where Jezebel was from, was a god named Baal. You read about him a lot in the Old Testament. Here's a picture of some ancient artifacts of Baal, some carvings, statues. That's a relief over there. Often he had a lightning bolt in his hand. And Baal was thought of as kind of a weather god. He controlled the rains and that sort of thing. Very popular among the cultures surrounding Israel. And so Jezebel and her family, they worship Baal. And she marries Ahab. And Ahab's like, great, we'll worship him too. They also worshiped Asherah, who looked like this. This was, she's like Baal's girlfriend. She's often like with him, consort. And so the two often go together, and so you read their names over and over. When you read the Old Testament, you keep hearing about Baal and Asherah, Baal and Asherah. And they set up these totem poles, and just this, that's what the culture was. And so Ahab, the king of Israel, whose whole, the nation of Israel's whole existence was predicated on their exclusive allegiance to their God based on the covenant, the king of Israel brazenly, publicly adopts this other worldview and religious system. And what this amounts to is state-sponsored idol worship. They funded this. They built altars and temples to these deities. And so this is why Elijah, speaking for God, goes to Ahab and says, there's not going to be any rain for a while. Because he's trying to snap Ahab out of this mindset. He's trying to get his attention. And if you understand that Baal is the weather god, lightning bolt, it's not an accident that he comes and says there's going to be no rain. Because Elijah is saying, you think Baal controls the weather, we'll see. There's not going to be any rain. And by the way, this is dangerous for Elijah to do because the kings of Israel did not like being called out. It's not like Ahab was like, oh, the prophet of Israel, of God, said this, you know, I could better listen. No. Elijah was in danger for calling out Ahab, and so he has to run. So let's keep reading what happens next. Verse 2, 1 Kings 17, says this. This is right after he confronted Ahab. It says, then the word of the Lord came to Elijah, leave here, turn eastward, and hide in the Kerith ravine east of the Jordan. You will drink from the brook, and I have directed the ravens to supply you with food there. So he did what the Lord had told him. He went to the Kerith ravine east of the Jordan and stayed there. The ravens brought him bread and meat in the morning and bread and meat in the evening. And he drank from the brook. So God is providing for Elijah in his time of trouble. He's out there in the desert. He's getting bread and meat twice a day, which is more than kings ate at that time. Kings, rich people, would eat meat maybe once a day. He's getting it twice a day. And so this ironic picture of the faithful Elijah alone in the desert, feasting like a king, and Israel in the land, experiencing a famine and droughts because of their unfaithfulness. Let's keep going. Verse 7. So he's out there in the desert. It says this, sometime later, the brook dried up because there'd been no rain in the land. Then the word of the Lord came to him, go at once to Zarephath in the region of Sidon and stay there. I've directed a widow there to supply you with food. So he went to Zarephath. When he came to the town gate, a widow was there gathering sticks. He called to her and asked, would you bring me a little water in a jar so that I may have a drink? As she was going to get it, he called, "And bring me, please, a piece of bread." "As surely as the Lord your God lives," she replied, "I don't have any bread, only a handful of flour in a jar and a little olive oil in a jug. I am gathering a few sticks to take home and make a meal for myself and my son, that we may eat it and die." Elijah said to her, "Don't be afraid. Go home and do as you've said, but first make a small loaf of bread for me from what you have and bring it to me, and then make something for yourself and your son. For this is what the Lord, the God of Israel, says. The jar of flour will not be used up, and the jug of oil will not run dry until the day the Lord sends rain on the land." She went away and did as Elijah had told her. So there was food every day for Elijah and for the woman and her family, for the jar of flour was not used up and the jug of oil did not run dry, in keeping with the word of the Lord spoken by Elijah. So many surprising elements in that part of our story. So he goes to Zarephath. Now let's look at a map and see where Zarephath is, all right? So Israel, the heartland of Israel, is kind of here. Zarephath, I don't know if you can see the giant red arrow at the top. That's where Zarephath is. It's way up north on the coast in Phoenicia. That's where Jezebel's from. That's the heartland of Baal worship. You know, God says, go there. I'm going to take care of you there. And I'm not going to provide for you by some rich person or some obvious way. I'm going to ask this poor widow who thinks she's about to eat her last meal. I'm going to have her provide for you. And you know, he goes to her and makes this request. It's like, what? You know, she's like, do I strike you as a person who has a lot of extra food? I mean, I am about to eat my last meal with my son, and you're asking me for food. But she trusted Elijah, and God provided. Another testament that God is the one who provides. He provides. Baal does not. He's thought of as the weather god. There's no rain. And here the God of Israel provides without a drop of rain coming from the sky. And God is teaching the widow and her son about who is the true God. So let's finish this section out. This is the last portion we'll read for today, and then we'll pull out some application. Starting in verse 17, he's still with the widow and her son in Zarephath. It says this: "Sometime later, the son of the woman who owned the house became ill. He grew worse and worse, and finally stopped breathing. She said to Elijah, 'What do you have against me, man of God? Did you come to remind me of my sin and kill my son?' 'Give me your son,' Elijah replied. He took him from her arms, carried him to the upper room where he was staying, and laid him on his bed. Then he cried out to the Lord, 'Lord, my God, have you brought tragedy even on this widow I'm staying with by causing her son to die?' Then he stretched himself out on the boy three times and cried out to the Lord, 'Lord, my God, let this boy's life return to him.' The Lord heard Elijah's cry, and the boy's life returned to him, and he lived. Elijah picked up the child, carried him down from the room into the house. He gave him to his mother and said, 'Look, your son is alive.' Then the woman said to Elijah, 'Now I know that you are a man of God and that the word of the Lord from your mouth is the truth.'" So there you see the ultimate provision that God provides is resurrection. It's new life. The woman's response, I think, to her boy's death sounds very modern. To me, you know, what did I do wrong? This bad thing happened. I must have done something bad that caused this. God's punishing me. And that's a very common way that we tend to think sometimes about God. There's like this equation, you know, good thing happened in my life. I did something good to deserve it. Bad thing happened in my life. I did something bad to deserve it. That's what she's saying. And to some extent, Elijah, when he says, you know, God, did you, you know, why are you doing this? But that view is a thoroughly pagan one, because that is what the pagan religious ritual looked like. Was the gods aren't necessarily that interested in you. They're not necessarily on your side. You've got to keep them happy and make little sacrifices and little offerings all the time and just hope that maybe they'll be nice to you. That is the pagan outlook on religion. And that is not the biblical view of a loving and trustworthy God who works through and even in spite of the difficult circumstances in our life. I just think her final comment was so remarkable. The word of the Lord from your mouth is truth. You have the proclamation of God's truth and power on the lips of a pagan woman when the king of Israel is worshiping idols from where she lives. So what's the lesson for us? What can we learn from Elijah's situation, the culture he was facing? How does it compare to our world? How can we embrace a biblical worldview as Elijah did? Here's the key point, one sentence, and we'll unpack what this means. As you live counterculturally, expect rejection and anticipate restoration. As you live counterculturally, expect rejection and anticipate restoration. Rejection and restoration. You see these paired over and over in Scripture, not just in the life of Elijah. You often see God's restorative work being done through men and women who are experiencing rejection on some level. You see it over and over again. And so we've got to expect that. So let's talk for a moment about what that looks like to expect rejection, and then we'll come back to the restoration piece. When you live out your faith in cultures that are headed away from God or are disregarding who God is, you must expect rejection on some level, and you're going to see it in other people too. Now, it doesn't mean that we're going to be out in the desert like Elijah was. It may not be that we fear for our physical safety like believers do in North Korea today or China or Iran or parts of India, places like that. But it might mean that your friends distance themselves from you. That might happen. I experienced that. When I was a senior in high school, my life and my priorities was kind of definitively moving in the direction of church and my faith and following Jesus. Not that I wasn't a believer before that, but that was just the season of my life where God really allowed me to kind of put it on the front burner. And I had these three friends who I'd been friends with since elementary school, like my best friends. And I found that in my senior year, they just weren't inviting me to stuff anymore. There was no, like, confrontation or anything. I could sense them disengaging from our friendship. And so me being the person that cannot stand passive aggression, I called them out on this. And I was like, let's all have dinner. And so I invited them to come and meet me for dinner at Johnny Carino's, of all places. And I just said, what's going on? You know, are we not friends anymore? Like, what is this? And they all three kind of had different answers. One of them was like, I'm really sorry. I just kind of felt guilty around you a lot. I'm actually still friends with that guy. We've been friends forever. Another one said, well, I just didn't think you'd be interested in hanging out with us anymore. And one of them just flat out told me, I don't think we'd be friends anymore because I'm not about any of that. And so I experienced a little bit of that. You may find yourself being left out of work conversations. You may find yourself being treated as if you're kind of old-fashioned. You may experience some low-level mockery or people unfriending you online or some antagonism on social media. You've got to expect this. And you've got to expect that it's going to happen for your kids and your friends. It's the way that it is. I went to a conference this week and heard a pastor named Pete Briscoe talking about this issue. And he said it this way. He said, if you're in with Jesus, you'll be out with the in crowd. It's true. Word of caution, though. When that rejection happens, we have to be careful about how you respond, because you can respond in two ways. The first way, I think, is the most natural, and it's you put the fists up, you know, I'm going to jump into this culture war while the water's warm. Here we go. I'm going to argue with people about Jesus. I'm going to rant about this. And we forget about loving people. We respond wrongly, even if we're in the right. The other option is we follow Christ's example. You know, Jesus loved people even as they were rejecting him. He loved them through his own rejection. And so if you want to change culture, you want to live counterculturally, the best approach is not to look at the culture around and go, oh man, these people are way off the map. I got to fix them. You know, no, it's to examine your own heart. It's to start with your interior culture and say, God, what do you need to change in me? What needs to be shaped? And that's really the only reliable way to live counterculturally on multiple fronts in a godly way, is to focus on your own heart and ask Christ to change you. Because if you do that, if you're seeking after Christ, if you're making your greatest desire to be growing closer to him and look more and more like him, as a result, you will find yourself living counterculturally. Not because you're trying to make this stark contrast and point out who's wrong and you're right, but that if you pursue Christ, you're going to find that you're living counterculturally. He's going to lead you there. But you've got to expect rejection on some level. Jesus said, if they persecuted me, they're going to persecute you. If it happened to me, you better believe it's going to happen to you. And they did it with Elijah as well. But now for the good news. Anticipate restoration. As we live counterculturally, we can expect the rejection, but we can also anticipate the restoration. You see, God restores. That's what he does. He restores. And if you make your life about him, you will see restoration in many forms, in big ways and small, around you. You know, I think Elijah was probably surprised at the restoration God had in mind for this widow and her son, you know, these pagans living out there who aren't even thinking about the God of Israel. And yet God in his sovereignty says, you know, I've got something to do in that family's life. And he restored them. He brought them close to him. And if in your life you are following Christ, you're going to see people around you draw near to him. You're going to see relationships healed. You're going to see grudges forgiven. You're going to see bridges built across chasms of culture that could only be built through Christ. God restores, and he is at work doing that even in the most turbulent of times. Did God immediately depose Ahab for his idolatry? No. Did he force the Israelites to worship him and him alone? No. Does that mean that God was not in control or he's not trustworthy? No. As God does his restorative work in your life and in the community, you know what? He's going to surprise you. It's not always going to look like you think it will. You can't put God in a box and expect him to only work in certain ways and in certain times through certain types of people that you think make sense. He might use people very far from him to do his work. He did that here with the pagan widow, and he does it. There's all kinds of other examples in scripture and in history as well, where God uses the most unlikely people to do his work. And so you see these two ideas in Elijah, the rejection and the restoration. They're often linked in scripture. So many stories in the Bible are about that, is some form of rejection and restoration that comes out of it. And of course, we see that most definitively in Christ. He was rejected, by and large, by his own people. He was truly innocent and yet gave his life for us to pay for our sins. Through his rejection, we are restored. Or in the words of Isaiah, by his wounds are we healed. Rejection and restoration. And you might think, if you're maybe new to church, you're just exploring this whole Jesus thing, or maybe you've kind of not been that close to God recently, you haven't felt that way, you might assume that God's default posture toward you is rejection. You know, it's like you're just rejected as if you do something to get out of being rejected. You know, you've got to just become a nice person, or you've got to become a moral person and live up to these standards. That is not at all what it is. You know, you don't have to prove your worth to God. He loves you. He has already given himself for you to extend that hand to you out of love, the hand of restoration. It's up to you whether you take it. And if you do, you experience spiritual transformation. You go from death to life. You become a new creation. It's because of Christ's rejection that he can offer you this hand of restoration. But it's hard for us to accept all of this because rejection and restoration don't seem to really go together. And often in times of turbulence in our own lives or in our culture, we think, again, if God's in control, there shouldn't be any discord. There shouldn't be faithlessness. There shouldn't be famine. There shouldn't be pain or death or social division because we're expecting God to act in the way we think would make the most sense. And in the case of Elijah and many others, God works in surprising ways through people and in methods that we would not think make sense. But God, again, he does not play by our rules. We cannot put him in a box. God is not tame. And Jesus is our greatest example. He was not the conquering political military figure people expected the Messiah to be. No, he was a humble carpenter from an out-of-the-way town that no one would have thought anything great would ever come from. That's how God chose to come. And so many elements of Jesus' life and ministry, you just see those echoes of Elijah's life and ministry. Did you know there's so many similarities? People thought Jesus might be Elijah. Like, Elijah's back. Look at this guy. Look at this, in Matthew 16, Jesus, verse 13, when Jesus came to the region of Caesarea Philippi, he asked his disciples, "Who do people say the Son of Man is?" He called himself the Son of Man. "Who do people say that I am?" They replied, "Some say John the Baptist, others say Elijah, and still others, Jeremiah or one of the prophets." "But what about you?" he asked. "Who do you say I am?" Simon Peter answered, "You are the Messiah, the Son of the living God." So there was much about Jesus' personality and his ministry and what he did that had affinities with what Elijah was about. Elijah was rejected by his own people. Jesus was rejected by his own hometown where he grew up. And when that happened, Jesus referred to Elijah to explain what was going on. Look at this in Luke 4. Jesus went to Nazareth. He tells them his message. He's kicking off his ministry. They say, we don't believe you. And this is what he says. Jesus said, "Truly I tell you," he continued, "no prophet is accepted in his hometown. I assure you that there were many widows in Israel in Elijah's time when the sky was shut for 3.5 years and there was a severe famine throughout the land. Yet Elijah was not sent to any of them, but to a widow in Zarephath in the region of Sidon." He's referring to the very story we just read to explain his own rejection. Jesus brought his message in surprising ways to surprising, unexpected places. The same places, by the way, that Elijah visited. For example, in Mark 7, it says this: Jesus left the vicinity of Tyre and went through Sidon down to the Sea of Galilee and into the region of the Decapolis. So Sidon, where Ahab's wife Jezebel was from, where the widow of Zarephath was from, Jesus went to that same place. There are these echoes of Elijah's ministry. When Jesus had a few loaves of bread and fish, and everyone's like, "This isn't going to feed everybody," he said, "Well, okay, watch this." It's reminiscent of the widow's jar and the flour and the oil that God miraculously multiplied that to provide. And in the same way that Elijah brought about some restoration in his ministry, of course, Jesus' whole ministry was about restoration. And we see a resurrection in Elijah's ministry. And of course, Jesus raised Lazarus to new life, and he himself was resurrected. And so you're just seeing these foreshadowings in Elijah's life of ultimately what God would do through Christ. And Jesus, like Elijah's time, lived in a time of cultural upheaval. The Romans are ruling the Jews. The Jews are splintered into all these factions. Seems like total chaos, but through Christ, God is in control, and he's in the midst of the greatest intervention in history for our restoration. But he had to be rejected. He was rejected before that restoration could come about. Like Elijah, like Christ, like all the forerunners of our faith, we are called to trust God while we live counterculturally, listen to his voice above all others, and expect that we're going to experience some level of rejection, but that we will also see moments of restoration, and we will experience restoration ourselves and anticipate the final restoration of heaven and earth at the end of time promised because of Christ.